KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
25 minutes.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Ben Benjamin has reached a low point. His wife has left. He's lost his home, his family, and his job. So he takes a class called Fundamentals of Caregiving, and he's assigned his first client, a 19-year-old boy with advanced muscular dystrophy. Not the most promising premise for a rollicking road trip story, but novelist Jonathan Evason makes it so in his novel, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. It's Jonathan Evason's third novel, all about Lulu, his first, won the Washington State Book Award. His second, West of Here, was a New York Times bestseller. He's executive editor for the arts website, The Nervous Breakdown. He's the mysterious fourth guy at the blog, Three Guys, One Book. Jonathan Evason lives on Bainbridge Island with his family here in the Northwest. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me, Ross.
It took you a long time to get to your first novel. I read that you wrote six novels first, and you physically buried.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I physically dug a hole and, salted the earth so that nothing would ever grow there again. And it's more ceremony than any of them deserved, actually.
How did you keep going? I mean, after six, some people would have said, maybe I'm not cut out for this.
Because I have to, you know. That's what I always tell people that are, you know, young writers. Is like, I mean, like, if you're going to make it in this game, you're going to have to write for some other reason than publication. I mean, to be quite honest, I wasn't even really that disappointed by the whole experience. I mean, you know, I licked envelopes and sent my stuff out as a matter of due diligence. But, you know, the reason I do this is completely selfish. I don't do this for awards or money or anything like that. Those things are all wonderful, but like I write because I feel like it makes me a more expansive person.
Yeah. Were you always like that as a kid? Were you writing, or did at some point did that click on? This is what I want to do. This is what I need to do.
Yeah, I guess if there's one thing that drew me toward writing, if I have like one skill, sort of native skill that helps me in writing, it's that I've always been very empathic, and so. I've always liked to sort of, but I'm far too self-conscious to be an actor. But basically, writing novels is the same thing that, like, an actor for me. I mean, my books are always character-driven, so for me, it's a matter of leaping through that empathic window and walking a mile in other characters' shoes. And doing so, I just feel like it makes me a more expansive person because I'm always looking at the world through the perspectives of different people, and they live inside me. It all sounds kind of schizophrenic, but the bottom line is. It would be serving me well as a human being, whether or not anybody was buying it. So, yeah, I had like six novels, maybe a memoir, and a collection of stories before I had any luck with Lulu.
Have it ever occurred to you that, boy, if I just could dig those three up, I'd find some nugget there that I could reuse someplace down the line?
No, the only thing that occurs to me is I just hope to God nobody has a copy. Like maybe I gave one to my dad or something like that. No, they deserve to be buried for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always knew it was going to take a long time to be good at this. I mean, I approached it like an athlete, I think, you know? I mean, by the time I was done with my first novel, it was a novel about a guy trying to finish his first novel, you know? The fourth wall was gone. It was so indulgent and you know, the second a little less so, and then the third maybe I started hitting my stride. And by the time I wrote the fourth book and the fifth book and the sixth book and the seventh book and the eighth book, they were good. Those books, I've had offers for some of them. Those mm-hmm. books I could maybe publish, but you know, why?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on, of course, in the revised fundamentals of caregiving, but one of the themes is kind of summarized in a line towards the end. I'm going to just read a little bit of it. Listen to me. Everything you think you know, every relationship you've ever taken for granted, every plan or possibility you've ever hatched, every conceit or endeavor you've ever concocted can be stripped from you in an instant. And this relates in part to some experiences you've had in your own life, things gone in an instant.
Yeah, my sister was killed in a freak accident the weekend of her 16th birthday, and the circumstances of it have never been, you know, adequately explained to anybody, not the police report or anything. So I saw what that did to my family and how my family is sort of forever stuck at that moment, like Mrs. Havisham, like all the clocks stopped, and emotionally everyone's still kind of at that place still, you know. So writing this book was sort of cathartic for me. You know, like, we know every day we know we could step off a curb. You know, we live with this reality every day that we can just step off a curb and get hit by a bus and we can end an instant. And we go crazy if we live like that. You know what I mean? At the same time, I think it's so helpful and so, important to have that reminder, and I wanted to write this book as a reminder. It sounds like a total drag when you describe it to people, a guy with two dead kids. But, I mean, really, it is funny, uplifting. I think it's a very uplifting book. I think, you know, I think people that connect with the book say they feel renewed after they read it. I think The New Yorker described it as like a, what did they say? It was like a secular saint's journey kind of thing, you know, like the series of humiliations and ultimately, you know.
And it's a road trip. Everybody loves a road trip. And I, one of the particular things that I liked about it that was just one of the jokier things, but Ben's taking care of this teenager, Trevor, and Trevor's got muscular dystrophy and he's required to get constant care and he's sexually frustrated. So a lot of his conversation with Ben is about sex, specifically these kind of unexplained sex acts, including gorilla mask, Bulgarian gas mask, and German knuckle cake. So I'm reading this along. I think, oh, that's so funny. He's come up with these kind of kooky names for these imaginary sex acts. Turns out not so imaginary.
No, I mean, you can Google them. I don't recommend it.
Which I did.
I think I actually accounted for a few of them on the Urban Dictionary. I think I might have made a few up. You know, it's funny because some female critic kind of called me out on those as being sort of like misogynistic or something. And I'm like, boy, lady, what you don't know about the male figure in crisis could fill volumes. Because, I mean, that's what's going on there. There's a lot of this sort of flippant misogyny between these two characters who are both sort of emotionally crippled. And they're just – that's masculinity in crisis for you. That's a big theme in this book.
I'm talking to Jonathan Evason, his most recent book, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. And it's said that people are more reluctant to talk about their personal finances than about their sex lives. So I was really interested to see you recently bared all for an article in The Stranger called How Much a Novelist Makes.
Oh, God, I know. Paul Constant at The Stranger asked me to do that as a favor because he'd been – but nobody would talk to him about it. And I'm like, whatever. I don't care. You know what I mean? I hope the IRS reads it, actually. So, you know.
You weren't lying about the low income?
Yeah, it's – well, you know, that article also – didn't include my most successful book. You know, I make a good living. It's all right. It isn't easy. I got to write a book every couple of years and stuff like that. But I think a lot of people think they're going to come out of an MFA program and get a six-figure advance and things like that. So the reason I did it was, you know, I was a little uncomfortable sharing that kind of information because it is personal, but I thought it would be instructive and helpful for people.
So it doesn't sound like you struggle sitting in front of the screen or the typewriter.
Oh, I live for it.
It flows.
Yeah, no, I get up at 5 a.m. I mean, it's my, you know, aside from my family, it's my greatest joy in life is to get up at 5 a.m., even though I'm a night person, and just, you know, get inside the fictive dream.
One thing that always amazes me about novelists, and particularly when I'm reading over The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, in its humor, is that you have to sit down and concentrate and focus and spend months and months in writing and rewriting, but then you have to do that for someone who's going to pick it up and whisk through it once. So somehow or other, you have to kind of remove yourself from all that internal work to figure out how someone's going to receive that the first time. And how do you do that?
Just try to please myself, I guess.
Yeah.
Just try to, you know, I really don't look at it as, I think of the end user in as much, in a sense, I never forget the reader. I want it to be entertaining. In certain literary fiction circles, that's become like pariah. It's like, you know, a lot of postmodern literature is, to me, and modernism too, you know, Faulkner and a lot of stuff is kind of holding the reader at arm's length. You know what I mean? I've always wanted to offer full access, the kind of access I got as a kid from like Jack London or something, where I'm inside the story and I feel the story. So mostly it's a matter of me really being inside the character. If I'm doing my job right, I'm living the novel and I'm feeling that novel with all my senses. And this is what I think brings it to life off the page. My books are sensuous. I mean, I'm very aware of smells and sounds and environments and you know, there's interior dialogue and there's intellectual stuff in there, but mostly it's more of a dance with the reader, I think, like sort of leading them to their own conclusions and you know, paying attention to things like rising action and catharsis in your characters and, you know, just your basic – I mean, at this point, like Aristotelian dramatics is just sort of intuitively works inside of me. You know, I mean, I don't think about it much.
And you were telling me you took a strategy that's novel to me. I mean, a lot of people think they have to get an agent to get the book before a publisher. You kind of figured out editors who you thought might like your work and went directly to them, and that worked for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had a bunch of agents. I had three, four agents, and they, nothing – nothing ever became of them. So with Lulu, my last agent was literally, it was Harriet Wasserman, and she was literally like 95 years old. But she was like a legendary agent. She had like Saul Bellow and Reynolds Price and me, you know what I mean? But she was already sort of halfway into retirement. In fact, after I left that agency and had already sold the book, her assistant emailed me to say, hey, can we try Jeff Klosky at Riverhead? And I'm like, yeah, I'm not with you guys anymore. I already sold the book. And just for the record, we already tried that guy. So after those like four books that were kind of close, like I had managed to open up some correspondences with editors, which you're not supposed to do, but I found their emails and they were appropriate editors. And so they would read my books and I started getting these near misses, like, please send me your next book. And then like 2 years later, they'd be like, oh, you again. And eventually I started to get offers with Lulu and then I could get any agent I wanted.
What's the first line of that letter that is in effect a cold call to someone who's probably hammered with authors that got them to read the second line, the third line?
Oh, good God, I don't remember. I'm just so glad I don't have to do it anymore. I'm kind of a loser at heart. I know because I actually sort of miss the rejection letters and the licking of the envelopes and all that due diligence. I actually kind of miss those 3 a.m. collating sessions at Kinko's. But one thing I do not miss is writing the perfect query letter. Right. It's agonizing. It's like writing I hate writing jacket copy, too. It's just, you know, it's hard. So I don't know. I have no advice to offer. Just be engaging.
Did you collect the rejection letters or bury them like the rejection?
I burned them eventually. I collected about 500 of them at least, and I kept them in this big box, a Kinko's box, if I recall, in my desk drawer. And I finally realized that, you know, this can't be good working next to all this rejection. And I actually went out and had a little bonfire with them, which was cathartic. And I'm not kidding. Like within the month, I started placing stories. I think I placed 3 stories within 4 weeks of burning the rejection. So it's all about, you know, we create our own perception to a large degree, I think. And I guess burning those rejections just was like getting a lot of failure off my back. They were the same stories.
That's like that Asian ceremony where you write down something you want to get rid of and you put it on a tree and then they burn the whole tree and everything gets burned up and everything's clear for you.
Yeah, I haven't figured out how it works, you know. I haven't read The Secret or anything like that, but I do feel like, you know, there are probably demonstrable laws of attraction at work. I mean, if you're out trying to get a date and you're thinking you're a loser and you're full of rejection and it's, you know, it'd be like trying to get a date when you're walking around with your, you know, the shadow of your 40 failed dates behind you. You're probably not going to get a date. And likewise, I think, you know, writing next to a box of 500 rejection letters can't help.
Jonathan Evason is my guest. His book is called The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, actually his third novel. You were mentioning that you just had a new baby just a few days ago, your second child.
Yeah, and my wife did most of the heavy lifting.
Did that, of course. But it is said that children take you totally out of yourself and make you think of the world in an entirely different way. And I imagine the life of a novelist is very internal. Did it change the way you thought about books, thought about writing to have children?
Well, you know, this book is about losing children, and I have a 3.5-year-old son, and he was a baby while I was writing this. And so, I mean, there was so much emotional drudgery. It was so painful for me to write, to face that possibility. But I think that's what gave it the intensity and that's why it's credible, I guess, or genuine. Well, like Obama said in his speech, you know, at the school, about, you know, it's like having your heart outside of your body. I mean, that's whoever said that was really wise. That's how it feels. It's like having this yourself outside of yourself and like, you know, just being constantly aware, seeing how my sister died and seeing, I mean, it's made me kind of a helicopter parent, man. I mean, it's like, you know, every time my kid's up the steps, I'm like right behind him with my arms because I just see how quick it's going to happen. And I know just like it says in the book, there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter how cautious you are. But, you know, I feel like I can help the odds, you know.
Jonathan Evason, you said that there are two things you simultaneously love and hate, William Faulkner and NPR. Well, everyone gets William Faulkner, but what's up with NPR?
Well, I love it. Don't get me wrong. I love it, but like it's like sometimes I'm going to get myself in trouble here. Now, not every NPR listener, but I don't know. Like there's a line in the book where Ben is sort of eavesdropping on his estranged wife's Facebook, and she sees he's with this guy, Jim Sunderland, and Ben says that he looks like an NPR listener. He looks like he'd bore you at a party. It's just, I guess I've been to a lot of parties where I've been cornered by people that are definitely NPR. Like, there's certain benchmarks to the NPR listener.
Which are?
Well, like Temple Grandin. I don't know. You guys have done so much stuff on Temple Grandin over the years that immediately when somebody's, you know, the word autism, somebody comes up, somebody's like, did you hear about the lady with the that invented the cow chutes? I mean, just over the years, you guys have done so much. So stuff like that. I actually, I mean, I love it. I love having come from a commercial radio background. I love that I don't have to listen to these truck advertisements. I love that everything's just, and I love everyone's intros. Like, I'm Ann Taylor and I'm Corey Flintoff. I mean, it's all kind of lo-fi and
that's a great Corey Flintoff, by the way. You totally nailed that one.
I'm Corey Flintoff.
You're the mysterious fourth guy on a blog called Three Guys in One Book. What goes on there? What happened?
Yeah, somebody, it was Paul from The Stranger, said that sounded like some sort of porno bukkake site, Three Guys, One Book. Well, my friends started this blog, Three Guys, One Book, and they all worked in book distribution for like companies back east that distributed books and bought books and sold books. And I was one of them when they started their blog. I was one of the first books they reviewed, and I started up a correspondence with them, and they said, hey, well, would you like to start blogging on our site? You know, we could call it Four Guys or whatever. And I'm like, no, just keep it Three Guys. And that takes the pressure off me. And
you've been on book tours. You got a chance to not only write the novels and sell the novels, but meet the people who read them. What sort of surprises you when you meet people who read your books? What do they tell you about them that maybe you hadn't thought of, or did they ever?
Oh, yeah, they surprise me. Mostly, I'm just impressed at how much my readers can drink. I mean, I think I've gone on 5 national tours in 4 years, and it's been a ball. I mean, it's so much better. I came up in bands, and it's so much better than a band tour where you're, like, stuck in a band with 4 farting teenagers. You know what I mean? It's like you got your own room at the Howard Johnson. You could kill the mini bar, fill my bathtub with ice, stock it with beer. And then I have a great time just going out with the booksellers. I really, really respect booksellers. They're my bread and butter, you know. I mean, it's independent booksellers that have given me a career. They built me, like, my first book was on a really small little publisher, and, you know, they can't afford what's called co-op, which is kind of pay to play, where you have to pay to get your books on table at the front of a Barnes & Noble or something. Well, independent booksellers, if they love a book, they'll put it on their staff recommendations wall, or they'll just sit and hand sell it. And one by one, I just, you know, traveled the country getting drunk with booksellers and you know, talking about our mutual passions for books and it's their support that's really put me in a kind of a unique position to be able to make a living writing literary fiction.
And how are they doing? I mean, we hear about the death of the small independent bookstores around the country. From the time you started going on book tours to now, do you sometimes go back to a city and that great store you went to a couple of years ago is no longer there?
Yeah, that happens. And I've also, you know, on the lowdown, about 3 or 4 booksellers, like after my event, I'll go, so interested in buying a bookstore. I mean, they're trying to sell me the bookstore, and someday I might do that. But I've heard, you know, what I'm hearing it from a lot of bookstores, is independent bookstores, is it was a really good holiday season. Like, everybody seems to be up from last year. And I don't know. I think the key to success for an independent bookstore is there's no cookie cutter. But really, I know that the successful ones all really infiltrate their community to the point where they're indispensable. Like Eagle Harbor Books in Bainbridge Island, it's been there for, you know, since the 70s. You know, I mean, they're in the classroom. They open their store up for events, outside events. They, you know, they've made themselves indispensable. And that's different. It's a different formula depending on the community. But the successful ones are always really keyed into their community.
Jonathan Evason, the latest living, breathing thing is The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. Thank you so much for stopping by. We really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. Cameron Drews helps us out on the production end. And Bernard Ouellette is in control. I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.